For the week of September 11th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 335, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're still down south.
I am, and you are in LA, but not for long.
No, actually, this week's show will be a bit abbreviated to allow for my attendance at this year's Geneva Convention, and that sounds way more political and worldly than what it actually is, which is a conference held by a chapter of the National Association of Theater Owners, NATO, in Wisconsin.
So instead of being in Geneva, Switzerland, you're going to eat a lot of cheese?
I guess so, yes.
Okay.
Maybe get one of those hats that you put on your head, you know, become a true cheesehead.
So it's going to be a short episode. We're not going to do big deal, big whoop. We're not going to have a big feature in the middle of the episode. What are we doing?
We're going to be talking about box office, of course, in a moment. And during our book filter segment, you, Michael, will have us talking to trees, really, literally. And on Inside Baseball, we'll take a look at the FCC's new rules regarding set-top boxes. They're not friendly rules, at least not to cable companies and certain electronics manufacturers. In 2 years' time, the pay TV industry may start losing out on an annual $20 billion in rental fees. But first, as always, as I just mentioned, Michael, we're going to turn it over to you, entertainment journalist extraordinaire, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world because there's no point in looking at anything else. We look at ComScore. We have a link to their website in our show notes. We also pull information from all the other outlets: LA Times, New York Times, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Mojo, BoxOffice.com, Box Office Profits, the numbers, you name it. Everyone agrees the number one movie around the world is Sully, the new movie starring Tom Hanks, who's back on top, who really almost has never been away from the top over like the last 30 years. It made $45 million on its opening weekend, doing better in North America than we expected and starting to launch overseas.
I'm surprised this movie is doing so well overseas. I mean, sure, the story kind of made headlines around the world of a pilot landing his damaged and crippled plane on the Hudson River in New York City. But still, I didn't think it really in Australia people would care.
It's Tom Hanks.
Oh, that's
true. He's a movie star. You know, you look at what he's done. He's had a really long, strong run of box office success. The same can't be said for Star Trek Beyond. It's just beginning to become a worldwide success as a movie franchise. That hadn't happened before. This movie may break that spell. Star Trek Beyond made $17 million over the weekend, $318 million worldwide. It's finally matched the domestic box office overseas. So in North America, it's made about $156 million. And internationally, it's made $161 million. Of course, we're still counting. There's more to go. It needs to double the domestic box office for this movie just to edge into the black. At number three is Don't Breathe, a horror film, $17 million over the weekend, $87 million worldwide, yet another low-budget success story in the apparently endless stream of horror flicks. At number four is The Secret Life of Pets, $16 million over the weekend, $790 million worldwide, and that's a good success story for Universal, who also has their new animated movie, Sing, that just debuted in Toronto and got pretty good reviews.
And think about it, I believe this movie, Secret Life of Pets, was released before Star Trek, okay? The summer's kind of fuzzy, but I'm pretty sure it was released before Star Trek, here in North America at least. Now, you look at, in North America, Star Trek Beyond, $935,000 this weekend, and yet Secret Life of Pets is still earning $1.5 million.
Right, it's a hit.
Yeah.
But of course, one movie's success does not always or usually or ever come at another movie's expense.
No. You know? I'm not comparing. I mean, I'm not trying to say that one is you know, causing...
Beat out the other, right?
No. I'm just saying, like, you can kind of look at the way the traffic patterns, if you will, of certain films.
Well, Star Trek series was never a massive box office franchise, you know, until the last two movies. It was really more modest by and large. It had good success in North America. It didn't even register overseas. So they're just starting. I don't know why. I mean, the TV series, I assume, was shown all over the world, and there have been five or six of them now, or seven. So I'm a little surprised it wasn't more of a feature overseas, but it wasn't. Nowadays, of course, it has to work worldwide. When you spend $185 million, that's not a North American play. It's got to make the money worldwide. We'll see where it ends up. Certainly, Korea is doing good. Their new movie, The Age of Shadows, is their official entry for the Oscars. It made $16 million on its opening weekend.
That's not bad.
It's by director Ji-Woon Kim. Do you know him?
Not personally.
Kim? Must be Kim. Ji-Woon Kim, I think.
Yes.
Yes. He did The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, sort of a spaghetti western type flick that played towards the end of Con 1 year. I remember seeing that and thinking it was fun.
Yeah, actually, now that you mention it, I know of the director and his work, but certainly don't know him personally.
Yeah. No, he's fun. He plays in a lot of different genres. He's very fun. He's not a typical Oscar type director that you think about when you think of the Oscars. You know, his are more popcorn movies and lots of fun different genres. But his new movie is The Age of Shadows. It's set in the 1930s. And it's their Oscar entry, so we'll have to see what it looks like. At number six is Suicide Squad, another $15 million, and now that has passed the $700 million mark worldwide.
A total flop, a total bomb. We can say that, at least with critics, because apparently it's making a mint. $700 million for a film that got critically panned and everybody thought was, you know, pretty much on death's door the second that it opened. Guess what? $700 million, that's a hit.
Yeah, just like Batman versus Superman. They're not good, but people are going. And number seven is When the Bow Breaks. $15 million on its opening weekend. Yet another scary movie opening solidly. I mean, it cost $10 million to make, and it made more than that on its opening weekend. That is a success story. And number eight is The Shallows, which apparently opened up in a few new countries. That's the Blake Lively B movie about a woman trapped in the shallows, surrounded by a shark, trying to get away. $9 million over the weekend, $110 million worldwide.
Although we should point out, it stars, you know, Blake Lively and a shark, not Blake Lively and a bee.
No, that's right.
Yeah,
and number nine is Nine Lives. Kevin Spacey gets turned into a cat to learn a lesson about life. $9 million over the weekend, $35 million worldwide. So I guess the lesson is, don't make bad movies. At number 10 is Ben-Hur, another $8 million, $65 million worldwide. It's playing in 55 territories. Again, there's nowhere for us to look, and unless we map out a single movie and pay attention and look up a lot of info, there's no chart or graph that says, oh, you've opened up in this many territories, you've played out, you have these big territories left. There's nowhere easy for us to go to get that information, or for anyone really, except you're, you know, in the industry and really following that stuff. We've had people comment on our Facebook and other places saying, oh, I don't like the way that they released. I don't like the way Disney released Finding Dory overseas. I thought they did a bad job with that. They left money on the table. I don't like that and the other thing. So there's a lot of things you could parse. But as far as Ben-Hur, it's in 55 territories, but that leaves another 40. Maybe there are big territories left. Maybe it'll make some money. We really don't know when that's going to happen or how. We just have to wait a couple months and then take another look at the box office.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, you know, roughly 75, 80 to 90, you know, between 75 and 90 territories, you're pretty much played out, right? But if one of those territories, I mean, here we have Ben-Hur playing in 55, if one of the remaining territories it has left to open is, say, China or Australia or
Japan,
you know, that's a big territory. There may not be a lot of territories left, but if they're big territories, box office wise, it matters.
Yeah, we're not saying the movie's going to turn to a hit, but we don't know what the end total is yet. It's certainly way below what they wanted.
Correct.
And number 11 is Jason Bourne. That's now at $390 million worldwide, so that's about to hit $400 million. So that's a happy little number for that movie. And number 12 is Bad Moms, $150 million worldwide, a huge success story for a movie that just costs $20 million to make. You could say the same for Sausage Party, the animated raunchy R-rated movie, $113 million worldwide. Looking down the charts, we've got Kubo and the Two Strings starting to make some money overseas. Pete's Dragon continues to underperform given its reviews. I think they opened that the wrong time of the year. Hell or High Water expanded even more here in North America, another $3.8 million. It's now at $21 million worldwide. Again, the movie cost $12 million to make, so let's not get ahead of ourselves. It needs to about triple that in order to be considered very roughly a success out of the box. But great reviews, great platform release. It's going to get end of the year attention. They can probably re-release it in January and get another spurt of attention depending on how big the end of the year accolades are. So, you know, this is going to be a movie that they'll make money on. How much, we don't know, but it's certainly a well-reviewed and well-released movie. The same cannot be said for The Wildlife, which is an animated French-American co-production, I think. It's sort of a Robinson Crusoe story, but naughtier, sillier, goofier, with lots more talking animals. And it opened to $3.4 million in North America. I'm not sure why it opened here, but that's what it did. And not every animated movie is going to make money.
You know, Lionsgate picked this film up. They did what's called a P&A pickup. And that's when you pick up a film and you say, look, I'll release it in this territory, and the only thing I'm going to pay for are the prints and advertising I'm not paying for anything else. I'm not paying a part of the production budget. I will pay what it costs to actually physically get it out there and market it. That's it.
Ah, and did they lose money on that deal? Did they get the video rights or what happens with that? How minimal is that?
I do not know. They may, very well may have gotten the home video rights for a specific term for a specific set of time.
And certainly not on the worldwide chart is The Disappointments Room. This is the first release from Relativity Media, which is newly reborn. This movie was sort of orphaned for a while. Now they've released it. It stars Kate Beckinsale, another horror, low-budget horror flick. There seems to be no end of them. This one was definitely a disappointment. I mean, I don't even think it's in the top 15, is it? I mean, it made just nothing at the box office, like $1.4 million in North America. So not a happy new start for Relativity.
Well, no, they also didn't have much of a marketing campaign for it.
Well, yeah, they don't have any money, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, when you want to market a movie, the best thing in the world is to get your director out front of the world. And that's what they've done with Nate Parker and Birth of a Nation. They said, hey, we've got to start going. They seemed like they had a plan. We're going to put him in Toronto. He's going to do some press junkets. He's going to do a press conference or two. We're going to be careful. You know, we're going to be careful. We're going to make sure he doesn't get, you know, barraged with bad questions. They had
You might want to explain why the bad questions would be coming. For those of you
a story about in his past, Nate Parker was involved in a rape case. His roommate and co-screenwriter was found guilty, and then on appeal was found the trial didn't go forward. Nate Parker was found innocent, but it was a very ugly rape case with all sorts of ugly allegations back and forth. The woman committed suicide in 2012, and now that he's a big star, people are paying more attention both to him. And now that people are a little more aware about rape and the continual problem of it on college campuses and all over the place, it's gotten in a lot more attention than it would have 10 or 20 years ago when people would have said, well, he wasn't found guilty, so I don't want to talk about it. Today, people say, all right, you were found innocent, but what happened? How do you feel about it? Do you apologize to the family? It's ugly. It's difficult, but they want to promote the movie. They brought him to Toronto, and their first premiere screening, there was an audience ovation and nobody booed or catcalled. They probably had a big sigh of relief. Then they went to the press conference and they did some press junkets. And their plan apparently was to tell him, don't talk about it. Go to the press junket. And when they ask you the question, yank the reporter away. A Canadian reporter started to raise the issue and they shut him down. And then he went to his press conference and somebody brought up the issue. So I don't want to talk about that.
Well, yeah, and he politely said, look,
that's your plan?
Yeah, this is a forum for, you know, everybody that's here to promote the film, not just mine. I don't want to hijack it. So I've spoken about it before. I'm sure I'll talk about it again. But this is not the forum to do so. I mean,
that you shouldn't have gone.
Yeah.
That's the stupidest PR plan I've ever heard of. Go there. Everybody wants to talk about it. You've got to put it behind you. And the best way is to just keep answering questions. Be trained on how best to respond. Talk about and think about what you're going to say. Deal with the questions until everybody's asked out and you can move on. Until they're bored asking about it. You know, there's not much new to say. So answer the questions. Be as sensitive and intelligent as you can. Show remorse. And they will eventually get tired of asking questions. Instead, you go there and you stoke the fire by saying, well, I don't want to talk about that. Well, then why?
Well, now we're just going to keep asking you about it. That's really what you've said. You're going to keep asking me about it because I didn't address the issue here. I can understand, you know, maybe their approach. I don't necessarily know that it was a wise one. If this is something they want to put behind them, this was not the way to go.
I don't understand their approach. I think it was stupid. If he was not going to talk, he shouldn't have gone. Which is bad. You know, you got to promote the movie. Get it behind you. Train. Think about what you're going to say. Practice it. Think about all the different kind of questions you're going to get, how you want to nuance it and present your point of view as you know, sensitively as possible, which he's tried to do in print and in an interview with Ebony and elsewhere. But to just say, well, now I'm done talking about it, it's not going to work.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. And I thought Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's piece was quite good on the issue. He had a piece in The Hollywood Reporter. I think the fact that it got two standing ovations at both screenings in Toronto means absolutely nothing because it's, you know, you can get a standing ovation for walking on stage at a film festival. It's not that hard. Yes, sure, in Cannes, people like to boo because it's become a thing in Cannes where if you're, you know,
for the press, the audiences don't typically boo.
Correct. And so that said, I think that, you know, you can't really tell what the public's response will be to The Birth of a Nation until it's out in the marketplace.
Yeah. Well, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar did have that essay in Hollywood Reporter. It was a review combined with his thoughts on How do you separate the artist from their personal lives and the work that they create? He's a very interesting, smart guy. He's written a lot of interesting stuff over the years, a collection of essays recently. He's got a mystery series. He's written a number of mysteries. I mean, he's a very smart, interesting guy.
And we should point out for international listeners, he is a former basketball player in the United States.
One of the most famous basketball players of all time.
Yeah.
And yeah, and it's a very good essay, well worth reading.
I do think it's interesting that The Birth of a Nation addresses a dirty past, and here a dirty past, or a potentially dirty past, an alleged dirty past is coming back to haunt the filmmaker of a film about a dirty past.
Is it a dirty past? It's just his wife gets raped and that's what gets him to kill people. It's not a dirty past.
Okay, well, yeah, I didn't really know the correct verbiage, but you understand. It's all about history.
Okay, yes. Yeah. Oh, right, it is about history. Okay, that works.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was trying to say.
I hear what you say and I acknowledge its worth.
Okay, well,
we're working on our marriage counseling, you know, where people don't know, you know, we're trying to work better on acknowledging I'm working better, and that's what my issues I got to acknowledge, you know, so I'm just trying that, so hopefully that worked.
Wait, are we seeing the same counselor? Am I seeing any counselor, actually? I don't think I am. In fact, speaking of not seeing things, I don't think I saw Warcraft. I know I didn't see Warcraft. Did you see Warcraft?
I did not see Warcraft, which may explain why when they make Warcraft 2, and they very well might, they won't even bother releasing it in the U.S.
Really?
Well, that's the idea. It set a record for a disparity for a film made by a Hollywood studio. The difference between domestic and international was kind of an all-time record. It was a huge hit in China, made money all over the world. And so now an analyst is speculating, hey, if they're going to make a sequel, why not double down on the China-centric casting? And why even bother releasing it in the U.S.? That's according to an article in The Wrap sent to us by Raul Burrell, who reached out to us, I think, via Facebook, didn't he?
Correct, yes.
And how can other people reach out to us?
Well, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. It's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
As far as Warcraft 2 is concerned, I would wait to see how it does on DVD and Blu-ray and video on demand and think about, you know, an off-calendar month, you know, January, August, you know, why not? You make a $100 million movie, you might as well release it in North America.
Who knows? Maybe you can become a cult hit on DVD and Blu-ray.
That's right.
But now you said an analyst had suggested this whole, you know, China first policy, right?
China only. Well, China only. Just no North America. To heck with us.
Okay. Well, you are an analyst when it comes to the book industry, which means it's time for us to check out Book Filter, a book lover's best friend. So, Michael, what is new this week? You're going to tell us about one book we should be reading, and it's the number one pick on bookfilter.com.
That's right. There's always a lot of great books in a lot of categories. A lot of people, of course, have read Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's been working on Black Panther, the comic book, and now they finally compiled the first run of comics into a trade paperback that came out this week. Carol Burnett, the great TV comedian, has a new memoir where she really focuses on her classic TV series and the making of that show. But my pick for the best book of the week, the one I just loved, is a nature book. It's a science book. It's called The Secret Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate, by a German named Peter Wohlleben. He's a scientist, a naturist, and it was a big bestseller in Germany and in Europe, and now it's coming to North America. It was a completely fascinating book. Trees communicate with each other. They communicate with other creatures. There's the wood wide web in which their roots stretch out so far and link into fungi, which link into other trees. They keep alive the stumps of their dead parents out of mourning. I mean, it's just crazy. A lot of it at the beginning sounds like anthropomorphism, but by the end, you kind of feel guilty if you pick up a piece of paper. You know, it's really a fascinating book written for the general public. Really interesting. A lot of cool stuff. I highly recommend it.
You know, actually, when you first started describing this book, I thought, I don't want to read this book. This sounds absolutely horrible, and it's going to make me feel guilty for having to take down the oak tree in the front of my house. Which
you know, because it's probably lonely and sad. Trees do not want to be alone. If I looked at your tree, from what I learned in the book about what trees like, where they should be positioned, a lot of trees are very unhappy. Your single oak tree in the middle of the yard, probably miserable.
It was a single oak tree actually out by the street, which was, you know, leaning into the street and, you know, blocking cars. So
yeah. No, it's not a happy tree.
Yeah. It was, especially after the chainsaw got to it.
Yes, you're a terrible man.
Now, as I mentioned, this is kind of a curtailed episode of Showbiz Sandbox, and thank you for bearing with us. So we're going to move right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. And boy, oh boy, does this story potentially affect at least everybody in North America up front. And ultimately, it could affect others throughout the rest of the world, especially if they are paying to rent their set-top box. And what I mean by that is paying to rent the cable box that they use to access television.
In other words, it affects everyone listening to this show.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I mean, we talked about this before. The FCC and Tom Wheeler, the head of the FCC, said, you know, we really have to examine this whole set-top box thing. The set-top box that a cable and pay TV provider offers is kind of locked to a provider. So if you have Comcast or...
It's a boondoggle.
Right. If you have Sky in the UK, it's locked to that particular provider.
They make you take their box and you pay a monthly fee for it.
Correct.
The technology is simple. Anybody should be able to just buy a box off the shelf, put it in their home, and the cable company or pay TV company should be have to provide their service through any generic box that's, you know, you don't have to buy their TV to watch TV. You shouldn't have to buy their set-top box. And instead of just buying a box for like $100 or $200, you pay $12 a month, month after month after month. It adds up to $20 billion in fees every year that in North America that the industry collects, when it should be a one-time payment of maybe $200 and then you're done.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, on average, the U.S. consumer pays $231 per year to rent one set-top box.
And that's more than it should cost outright.
Yes, that is, you know, even once the cost of the box is recouped, you just keep paying for it again. I mean, the box that's sitting in the studio here, it's been around for, what, like 8 years?
And not only that, but you end up with outdated technology. And if it breaks and you take it back in, they tend to replace it with the same one. They don't even, you have to fight to upgrade sometimes to one with a bigger capacity and all this stuff. It's just crazy. And again, think of it this way. If they forced you to buy their TV to watch TV and you had to rent the TV every month, you'd be furious. You would not accept that.
Well, and this isn't acceptable. About this. If you really want to put this in perspective, just the rental fees for these, as you call them, antiquated, and I agree, antiquated boxes, these set-top boxes, is $20 billion annually to Comcast, to Charter, to all of the hundreds of cable companies out there.
And the party is over.
Well, $11 billion, $11.4 billion, let's call it, is the North American box office, including Canada. Okay, so that should tell you $9 billion more, and you get your rental fees for the cable industry. So it's dwarfing even, you know, almost by, you know, 50% or 100% the North American theatrical box office.
That's right. So Tom Wheeler, the head of the FCC, penned an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times about set-top boxes and the new rules. My question to you is, why would it be in the LA Times?
Well, because the Los Angeles Times is a paper of record in a company town. This is this is where the entertainment industry, at least in North America, is based.
And as Bill Maher would say, what are the new rules?
Well, these rules would require companies to provide an app or apps or numerous apps, apps that other companies make, maybe all free of charge that you can put on, you know, whether it's Apple TV or Roku or their own set-top box that you could access television either, you know, through the cable TV provider.
Any way you want.
Or through these apps. But then it goes a bit farther. It goes into integrated search, which would then improve the ability for people to then kind of search for, let's say, I don't know, Seinfeld or Friends or, you know, Black-ish. And you would be able to figure out, I can watch it on ABC or I can watch it on Hulu or I can watch it on Netflix. And it would all be as if you were just changing the channel. It wouldn't be difficult to find.
This has to be the most progressive thing that they did. They didn't just say, all right, you've got to stop renting the boxes. People got to be able to buy their own boxes. They want to step forward. And as we've talked about, there's a big problem of figuring out where stuff is.
Correct.
For consumers, it's really hard to say, I want to watch, you know, last season of Archer. Where do I go? What do I do? There are apps for it. There's things. But they might have held on to their information about what they were showing and tried to not make it compatible with everybody else. And he's saying, no, you've got to make your info available by what you're showing in all your different ways. So if you've got something on video on demand, anybody can see it looking at any box that they want.
Correct. And what the cable companies would say is, look, we are a provider. if we charge ABC, NBC, Comedy Central, MTV, we charge them for carriage and we get them into homes. Okay. We will do the same thing for apps. You can't force us to carry an app that nobody gives us.
Well, they just did.
Right. And so,
I think the thing is, they're just saying, look, you can't make your service not work with other apps and other boxes. You can't make some crappy, no use service and say, oh, we fulfilled our obligation. They're saying, yeah, no. You got to make it compatible with other things. You've got to make your information available. It's got to work right for everybody, not just via your box.
Right. And of course, what do you think the response from the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, what do you think their response was?
Weeping, wailing, the gnashing of teeth?
Probably all of those things. But then, of course, they released a statement that said, this proposal would far exceed the commission's legal authority and improperly insert the government into private contract negotiations between pay TV distributors, content creators, and device manufacturers.
They said.
All very legalistic. Basically, they're saying, hey, aren't you guys supposed to be worried about the auction and providing, spectrum and infrastructure? Why are you worried about content all of a sudden? That's not your bailiwick.
Because you're ripping off customers of $20 billion a year in unnecessary fees. And that's exactly why they should be involved. And they don't want to try to set up new rules and have you jerry-rig it so that it doesn't work poorly unless you're using their box. And they're doing exactly what they should be doing.
Well, and even if they know, and they being the FCC, even if they feel like, okay, yes, we can mandate that, the set-top box thing has to go away. And we'll even try and mandate these apps and the way that the interfaces should work, even though we know that will never fly. It's just a negotiating chip that they can say, okay, we won't regulate the whole app thing, but the set-top boxes we'll have to compromise on.
I don't think this is a negotiating ploy. I think this is what should be done. And they've given them 2 years to do it. The big companies have 2 years
to
implement
this. Well, it has to be approved. It has to be approved.
That's right. And it will be approved.
Do you think it will? I wonder if...
Why not? There's nothing remotely unusual or untoward about this. There may be a court case to challenge it, and then they will triumph in court because companies cannot possibly defend charging a monthly fee for a set-top box when there's millions of alternatives that could work just as fine. You don't have to use their TV. You shouldn't have to use their set-top box. Have to use their remote.
And I'm not being just contrarian. I would say their argument would be, and this is the pay TV providers, their argument... And this is the only one that I could see maybe sticking, is that there's technology in their set-top boxes which help them control fraud and control, be able to provide the service to begin with. Whereas if you just go to the store like Best Buy or Fnac or your local, electronics store, well, those devices may not have that type of technology in it.
Unfortunately, they already make their apps and things available via Apple TV and Roku and Xbox and all these other things and via smart TVs. And there's no way, if they're making it available to them, they cannot then turn around and say, but of course they're defrauding everybody, so we can't make that official.
Well, and this isn't the first time this happened, okay? Because if you remember, you used to have to rent your phone from the phone company.
That's right.
And so the FCC came along and others came along and said, hey, we're going to stop that. And you could go out and then buy your own phone. So now how does this affect international listeners? And here's how. I mean, right now, markets like China, markets like the U.S., these big giant markets that all these set-top boxes are needed for, they actually cause manufacturers, electronics manufacturers, to build those boxes. Apple TV, Roku, Xbox, all of those are built with an international audience in mind. Well, right now, all these electronics manufacturers are building for certain markets first, but knowing that they can go to Europe or Scandinavia or Russia and sell those boxes onward. If the FCC kind of mandates freedom of set-top boxes, well, there will be fewer set-top boxes for other markets to enjoy as well.
That's right. But the good news is, we talked about all the mom and pop cable providers that are out there in North America. There's hundreds of little ones, right?
Yes.
They never have to implement these rules.
Correct.
They'll probably want to just to keep pace with the Joneses. The medium-sized companies, I don't know what that means, but they have 4 years to implement the rules. And the big companies, which means most of them and the people you probably get your cable from, like Time Warner Cable, they have to do it in 2 years. So in other words, they get an extra $40 billion. You know what? Enjoy your final $40 billion and put this through.
Well, and let's face it, they will still wind up, you know, there will be people that keep their set-top box because it's just easier. You know,
absolutely.
They're just going to, you know what, I'll just keep the set-top. There will be people who don't know that this rule is in effect. And they'll just continue to assume that they have, you know, have to rent the set-top box. As far as those smaller companies that don't have to comply, there's an example of a company that may not be able to put the infrastructure in place to comply. And that's why they're not, you know, they're kind of left out of it and they're grandfathered in. And that's that technology I was referring to, where the set-top box is actually tied to the head end, providing the service to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
That is completely understandable. A lot of these services are in rural areas where the big boys like Comcast and Charter, they don't want to play. So they don't want to service those areas because it's too expensive for too little money. And so these, you know, often community
they
services
can't be bothered.
Yes, correct.
That's why there was no electricity until the government stepped in.
Yes.
All right.
So that's set-top boxes initially here in the U.S., eventually probably around the world. We'd love to know what people are doing in other countries. So please do write to us, call us, let us know. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. And that's 888-567-7263. You can find links to the stories we've discussed on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where the show notes for episode 335 can be found. That's where all of those ways to contact us can be found. Our website's a little sick right now. It used to be where you could find ways to follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle on Twitter. Or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the indie rock group MGMT. We have our own website, showbizsandbox.com. They have their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. And Michael Giltz has his own website. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's IamTheLoraxIspeakForTheTrees.com.
Oh, my goodness. A Dr. Seuss reference for those of you who aren't following along at home. Why is everybody following along at home this week?
I don't know.
But if you can't find any of Michael's writing on that website, definitely check out, thehuffingtonpost.com, where some of your coverage of the entertainment industry exists. You can also go to michaelgiltz.com, where all of your work is aggregated. And remember, always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
A trim 37 hours. Really? It's under an hour?
Yes.
It's amazing. All we have to do is cut half the show.